I fall into a nice groove with Darren in early 2002. We speak the same language, see the world in similar colors. Then he cements my trust, my unwavering confidence, by daring to fuss with my racket strings and improving them. I've always played with Pro Blend, a string that's half Kevlar, half nylon. You can reel in an 800-pound Marlin with Pro Blend. It never breaks, never forgives, but also never generates spin. It's like hitting the ball with a garbage can lid. People talk about the game changing, about players growing more powerful and rackets getting bigger. But the most dramatic change in recent years is the strings. The advent of a new elastic polyester string, which creates vicious topspin, has turned average players into greats and greats into legends. Still, I've always been reluctant to change. Now, Darren urges me to try. We're in Italy, at the Italian Open. I've just played Nicholas Kiefer from Germany in the first round. I've beaten him 6-3, 6-2, and I'm telling Darren that I should have lost. I played lousy. I have no confidence on this dirt, I tell him. The clay game has passed me by.
Give the new string a go, mate.
I frown. I'm skeptical. I tried changing my racket once. It wasn't pretty. He puts the string on one of my rackets and says again, "Just try." In a practice session, I don't miss a ball for 2 hours. Then I don't miss a ball for the rest of the tournament. I've never won the Italian Open before, but I win it now because of Darren and his miracle string. I suddenly look forward to the 2002 French Open. I'm excited, eager for the fight, and guardedly optimistic. I'm coming off a win, Jaden is sleeping a bit more, and I have a new weapon. In the fourth round, I'm down two sets and a break to a wild card, a Frenchman named Paul-Henri Mathieu. He's 20, but he's not in the shape I'm in. There's no clock in tennis, son. I can be out here all day. Down comes the rain. I sit in the locker room and reminisce about Brad yelling at me in 1999. I hear his tirade word for word. When we walk back onto the court, I'm smiling. I'm up 40 love, and Mathieu breaks me. I don't care. I simply break back. In the fifth set, he goes up 3-1. Again, I refuse to lose. If it had been anyone but Agassi, Mathieu tells reporters afterward, I would have won. Next I face Juan Carlos Ferrero from Spain. Again it rains. This time I ask that the match be halted for the night. Ferrero is ahead and he doesn't want to stop. He gets surly when officials grant my request and suspend the match. The next day he takes his surliness out on me. I have a small opportunity in the third set, but he quickly closes it. He wins the set, and I can see his confidence rising off him like steam as he closes me out. I feel peaceful walking with Darren off the court. I like the way I played. I've made mistakes, my game sprang leaks, but I know we'll work to patch them. My back is sore, but mostly from stooping to help Jaden walk. A wonderful soreness. Weeks later, we go to the 2002 Wimbledon, and my great new attitude abandons me, because my new string undoes me. On grass, my newly augmented topspin makes the ball sit up like a helium balloon. In the second round, I play Paradorn Sichapan from Thailand. He's good, but not this good. He's crushing everything I hit. He's ranked number 67, and I think it's impossible that he'll beat me. And then he breaks me in the first set. I try everything to get back on track. Nothing works. My ball is a cream puff, and Sichapan devours it. I've never seen an opponent's eyes grow quite so large as Sichapan's when he tees up my forehand. He's swinging from his heels, and my only conscious, coherent thought is, I wish I could swing from my heels and be rewarded. How can I let everyone in this stadium know that this isn't me? This isn't my fault. It's the strings. In the second set, I make adjustments, fight back, play well, but Tsitsipas is supremely confident. He thinks it's his day, and when you think it's your day, it usually is. He hits a wild shot that magically catches a piece of the back line, then wins a tiebreak, going up two sets. In the third set, I surrender peacefully. It's cold comfort that, the same day, Pete loses. Darren and I spend the next 2 days experimenting with different combinations of strings. I tell him I can't continue with this new polyester, and yet he's ruined me for the old string. If I have to go back to Pro Blend, I say, I won't play tennis anymore. He looks grim. After being my coach for 6 months, he's made one tiny adjustment to my strings, and he may have inadvertently hastened my retirement. He promises that he'll do everything in his power to find a combination of strings that's just right. Find something, I tell him, that lets me swing from my heels and get rewarded, like Tsitsipas. Make me like Tsitsipas.
Done, mate.
He works night and day and comes up with a combination he likes. We go to Los Angeles, and it's perfection. I win the Mercedes-Benz Cup. We go to Cincinnati, and I play well, just not well enough to win. Then in D.C., I beat Enqvist, always a tough matchup for me. I then face another kid who's supposed to be the next big thing, 22-year-old James Blake. He plays pretty, graceful tennis, and I'm not in his league, not today. He's simply younger, faster, a better athlete. He also thinks enough of my history, my accomplishments, to bring his A game. I like that he comes out loaded for bear. It's flattering, even though it means I have no chance. The loss is nothing I can blame on my strings. I go to the 2002 U.S. Open unsure of what to expect from myself. I sail through the early rounds, and in the quarters I face Max Mirny, a Belarusian from Minsk. They call him the Beast, and it's an understatement. He's 6'5" and hits a serve that's among the scariest I've ever faced. It has a burning yellow tail, like a comet, as it arcs high above the net and then swoops down upon you. I have no answer for that serve. He wins the first set with beastly ease. In the second set, however, Mirny makes several unforced errors, giving me a boost, a bit of momentum. I start to see his first serve a little better. We play high-quality tennis all the way to the finish, and when his last forehand flies long, I can't believe it. I'm in the semis. For my efforts, I win a date with Hewitt, the number one seed, the winner of this year's Wimbledon. More germane, he's Darren's former pupil. That Darren coached Hewitt for years adds an extra level of intensity and pressure. Darren wants me to beat Hewitt. I want to beat Hewitt for Darren. But in the first set, I quickly fall behind 0-3. I have all this information in my head about Hewitt, data from Darren and from past experience, but it takes a while to sort through the data and solve him. When I do, everything quickly changes. I storm back and win the first set 6-4. I see the pilot light in Hewitt's eyes go out. I win the second set. He rallies, wins the third. In the fourth set, he suddenly can't make a first serve, and I'm able to pounce on his second. Jesus, I'm in the final. Which means Pete. As always, Pete. We've played 33 times in our careers, 4 times in slam finals. He's got the overall edge, 19-14, and 3-1 in slam finals. He says I bring out the best in him, but I think he's brought out the worst in me. The night before the final, I can't help but think of all the different times I thought I was going to beat Pete, knew I was going to beat Pete, needed to beat Pete, only to lose. And his success against me started right here in New York 12 years ago when he stunned me in straight sets. I was the favorite then, as I am now. Sipping Gil's magic water before bed, I tell myself that this time will be different. Pete hasn't won a slam in more than 2 years. He's nearing the end. I'm just starting over. I climb under the covers and remember a time in Palm Springs several years ago. Brad and I were eating at an Italian restaurant, Mama Gina's, and we saw Pete eating with friends on the other side of the dining room. He stopped by and said hello on his way out. "Good luck tomorrow. You too." Then we watched him through the restaurant window, waiting for his car. We said nothing, each of us thinking of the difference he'd made in our lives. As Pete drove away, I asked Brad how much he thought Pete tipped the valet. Brad hooted.
"$5, tops."
"No way," I said. "The guy's got millions. He's earned 40 mil in prize money alone. He's got to be good for at least a 10 spot.
"Bet?"
"Bet." We ate fast and rushed outside. "Listen," I told the valet, "give us the absolute truth. How much did Mr. Sampras tip you?" The kid looked at his feet. He didn't want to tell. He was weighing, wondering if he was on a hidden camera show. We told the kid we had a bet riding on this, so we absolutely were insisting he tell us. He finally whispered, "You really want to know?"
"Shoot."
"He gave me $1. Brad put a hand on his heart. "But that's not all," the kid said. "He gave me $1, and he told me to be sure to give it to whichever kid actually brought his car around." We could not be more different, Pete and I. And as I fall asleep the night before, perhaps, our final, I vow that the world will see our differences tomorrow. We get a late start thanks to a New York Jets game that goes into overtime, delaying the TV broadcast, and this favors me. I'm in better shape, and I like that we're going to be out on the court until midnight, but I immediately fall behind 2 sets. Another drubbing at the hands of Pete. I cannot believe this is happening. Then I notice Pete looking wrung out and old. I win the 3rd set by 1 mile, and the whole stadium can feel the momentum slide my way. The crowd is crazy. They don't care who wins. They just want to see an Agassi-Sampras 5-setter. As the 4th set gets underway, I know, deep in my heart, as I always know with Pete, that if I can get this thing to a 5th set, I'll win. I'm fresher. I'm playing better. We're the oldest players to meet in the U.S. Open final in more than 30 years, but I'm feeling like one of the teenagers who have lately been kicking ass on tour. I feel like part of the new generation. At 3-4, Pete is serving, and I have 2 break points. If I win this game, I'll serve for the set. So this is it, the game of the match. He locks in, saves the 1st, and on the 2nd break point, I hit a scorching return to his shoes. I think the ball is well behind him. I'm already celebrating. But somehow, he turns and finds it and hits a half volley that flops and dies on my side of the net. Deuce. I'm spooked. Pete closes out the game, then goes on to break me. Now he's serving for the match, and when Pete serves for a match, he's a cold-blooded killer. Everything happens very fast. Ace, blur. Backhand volley, no way to reach it. Applause, handshake at the net. Pete gives me a friendly smile, a pat on the back, but the expression on his face is unmistakable. I've seen it before. "Here's $1, kid. Bring my car around." Chapter 27. I open my eyes slowly. I'm on the floor beside my bed. I sit up to say good morning to Stephanie, then realize she's in Vegas and I'm in St. Petersburg. No, wait, St. Petersburg was last week. I'm in Paris. No, Paris was after St. Petersburg. I'm in Shanghai. Yes, that's right, China. I go to the window, draw back the curtains. A skyline designed by someone on mushrooms. A skyline that looks like a sci-fi Vegas. Every building is crazily different, and all set against a hard blue sky. It doesn't matter where I am, strictly speaking, because parts of me are still in Russia and France and the last dozen places I've played. And the biggest part of me, as always, is home with Stephanie and Jaden. No matter where I am, however, the tennis court is the same, and so is the goal. I want to be number one at the end of 2002. If I can put together a win here in Shanghai, one little win, I'll be the oldest year-end number one in men's tennis history, breaking Connor's record.
He's a punk. You're a legend.
I want this, I tell myself. I don't need it, but I do want it. I order coffee from room service, then sit at the desk and write in my journal. It's not like me to keep a journal, but I've recently begun one, and it's quickly become a habit. I'm compelled to write. I'm obsessed with leaving a record, in part because I've developed a gnawing fear that I won't be around long enough for Jaden to know me. I live on airplanes, and with the world becoming more dangerous, more unpredictable, I fear that I won't be able to tell Jaden all that I've seen and learned. So every night, wherever I am, I jot a few lines to him. Random thoughts, impressions, lessons learned. Now before going to the Shanghai Stadium, I write,
Hey, buddy. You're in Vegas with Mom and I'm in Shanghai, missing you. I have a chance at finishing number one after this tournament, but I promise I can only think about getting home to you. I put a lot of pressure on myself with my tennis, but I'm strangely driven to continue. It took me a while to figure that out. I fought it for so long. Now I just work as hard as I can and let the rest fall where it may. It still doesn't feel great most of the time, but I push through it for the sake of so much good. Good for the game, good for your future, good for many at my school. Always value others, Jaden. There is so much peace in taking care of people. I love you, and am there for you always. I close the journal, walk out of the room, and get clipped by Yuri Novak from the Czech Republic. Humiliating. Worse, I can't leave the country and go home. I have to hang around an extra day to play a kind of consolation match. Back at the hotel, choked with emotion, I write again to Jaden. I just lost my match and I feel terrible. I don't want to go back out there tomorrow. So much so I was actually wishing for an injury. Picture that. Not wanting to do something so much that you wish upon yourself injury. Jaden, if you ever feel overwhelmed with something like I was tonight, just keep your head down and keep working and keep trying. Face it at its worst and realize it's not so bad. That will be your chance for peace. I wanted to quit and leave and go home and see you. It's hard to stay and play. It's easy to go home and be with you. That's why I'm staying. At the end of the year, as expected, Hewitt is number one. I tell Gil we need to take it up a notch. He outlines a new regimen for the older me. He pulls ideas from his Da Vinci notebooks, and we spend weeks working solely on my deteriorating lower body. Day in, day out, he stands over me as I build my legs, yelling,
Big Thunder! Australia's calling!
Weak legs command, Gil says.
Strong legs obey.
By the time we board the Ambien Express, Vegas to Melbourne, I feel as if I could run or swim there. I'm the second seed in the 2003 Australian Open, and I come out growling, ferocious. I reach the semis and beat Ferreira in 90 minutes. In six matches, I've dropped only one set. In the final, I face Rainer Schüttler from Germany. I win 3 straight sets, losing only 5 games, and tying the most lopsided victory ever at the Australian Open. My 8th slam, and it's my best performance ever. I tease Stephanie that it's like one of her matches, the closest I'll ever come to experiencing her kind of dominance. As they hand me the trophy, I tell the crowd, "There's not a single day that's guaranteed to us, and certainly days like this are very rare." Someone says later that I sounded as if I'd had a near-death experience. More like a near-life experience. It's how a person talks when he almost didn't live. I'm the oldest player in 31 years to win a slam, and reporters won't let me hear the end of it. Again and again, before I leave Australia, reporters ask if I have a plan for retirement. I tell them I don't plan endings any more than I plan beginnings. I'm the last of a generation, they say. Last of the 1980s Mohicans. Chang announces he's retiring. Courier is already 3 years into his retirement. People treat me like a codger because Stephanie is expecting again, and it's well known that we tool around Vegas in a minivan. Still, I feel eternal. Ironically, my lack of flexibility seems to be stretching out my career. It helps my durability. Since I can't turn well, I always keep the racket close to my body, always keep the ball out in front of me. Thus, I don't put unnecessary stress and torque on my frame. With such form, Gill says, my body might have another 3 years in it. After a short breather in Vegas, we fly to Key Biscayne. I've won this tournament 2 years in a row, 5 times overall, and nothing can stop me. I reach the final and beat Moya, my old adversary from the French Open, who's ranked number 5. Straight sets. My 6th win here, which tops Stephanie's record. Again, I tease her about finally doing something better than she did it. She's so competitive, however, I know not to tease her too much. Playing in the U.S. Men's Clay Court Championships in Houston, I just need to reach the finals and I'll be ranked number 1 again. And I do. I beat Jürgen Meltzer 6-4, 6-1 and go out with Darren and Gill to celebrate. I throw down several vodka cranberries. I don't care that I'm playing in the final against Roddick tomorrow. I'm already ranked number 1. Which is why I beat him. That perfect blend of caring and not caring. The best preparation. Days before my 33rd birthday, I'm the oldest player ever ranked number 1. I fly to Rome feeling like Ponce de Leon and get off the plane feeling a geriatric twinge in my shoulder. In the first round, I play poorly, but don't dwell on it. Put it out of my mind. Weeks later, at the 2003 French Open, my shoulder is still sore, but my practices are crisp. Darren says I'm a force. In the second round, I'm on the Suzanne Lenglen court, a court filled with bad memories. Losing to Woodruff in 1996, losing to Safin in 1998. I'm playing a kid from Croatia, Mario Ancic. I lose the first 2 sets and trail in the third. He's 19 years old, 6'5", a serve and volleyer with no fear of me. The Lenglen court is supposed to be denser, slower, but today the ball is moving fast. I'm having an unusually hard time controlling it. I gather myself, however, and win the next 2 sets. In the 5th, exhausted, my shoulder falling off, I have match point 4 times and lose them all. I double fault 3 of them. I beat the kid at last, but only because he's slightly more afraid of losing than I am. I'm in the quarters against Guillermo Coria from Argentina, another youngster. He says publicly I'm his idol. "Listen," I tell reporters, "I'd rather not be his idol and play him on hard court than be his idol and play him on clay." How I hate this dirt. I lose 4 of the first 5 games. Then I win the set. How I love this dirt. Coria shows no emotion, however. In the second set, he jumps out to a 5-1 lead. He misses nothing. He's fast and getting faster. Was I ever that fast? I try to confuse him, rush the net. To no avail. He's just better than me today. He knocks me out of the tournament and out of the number one slot. In England, at a warm-up tournament before Wimbledon, I beat Peter Luchak from Australia. It's the 1,000th match of my career. When someone tells me this, I feel an overpowering need to sit down. I have a glass of wine with Stephanie and try to run my mind over all 1,000 matches. I remember every one of them, I tell her. Of course, she says. For Stephanie's birthday, I take her to see Annie Lennox in London. She's one of Stephanie's favorites, but tonight she's my muse. Tonight she's singing, speaking directly to me. In fact, I make a point to tell Gil that we'll need to include some Lennox on Belly Cramps too. I might listen to her before every match. This is the path I'll never tread. These are the dreams I'll dream instead. I'm one of the favorites at the 2003 Wimbledon. How? No father has won Wimbledon since the 1980s. Fathers don't win slams. In the third round, I play Younes El Aynaoui from Morocco. He's a new father, too. I joke with reporters that I look forward to playing a man who gets as little sleep as I. In his pre-match instructions, Darren says, "When you get this guy bled out to the backhand early in the match, when you see him hit his slice, be sure to take it out of the air. That way, you'll put him on notice that he can't get away with safe shots from a defensive position. He needs to hit something special. That's how you send him a message early and force him into errors later in the match." Good advice. I quickly grab a lead, 2-1. But El Aynaoui won't cave. He pours it on in the fourth, gets 3 set points. I don't want this thing going 5. I refuse to let it go 5. The final points of the fourth set are grueling, and I do everything required, everything Darren advised. When it's over, when I've won the set and match, I'm wiped out. I have a day off, but I know it's not nearly enough. In the fourth round, I face Mark Philippoussis, an Australian kid with tons of talent and a reputation for squandering it. His serve is big, infamously big, and never bigger than today. He's topping out at 140 miles an hour. He aces me 46 times. Still, the match goes where we both know it's going, a fifth set. At 3-4, he's serving, and somehow I have break point. He misses the first serve. I taste the victory. He unloads a 138-mile-per-hour second serve straight up the middle. Obscene speed, but that's right where I thought he'd hit it. I put the racket out, reflex the ball back to him, and he can only stand and watch. He almost gets whiplash, and yet it lands 1/2 inch behind the baseline. Out. Had it fallen in, I'd have had the break, the momentum, and I'd be serving for the match. But it's not to be. Now, believing he can win, Philippoussis stands a little taller and breaks me. It's all gone in a blink. One minute, I'm almost serving for the match. The next minute, he's raising his arms in conquest. Tennis. In the locker room, my body feels different. Grass has become an ordeal, and a 5-setter on grass leaves me physically shattered. Also, the courts at Wimbledon are playing truer this year, which has meant longer rallies, more movement, more lunging and bending. My back is suddenly an issue. It's never been good, but now it's actively, troublingly bad. Pain runs from my back, down my butt, circumvents my knee, then reconnects with my shin and shoots down to my ankle. I'm grateful that I haven't beaten Philippoussis, that I haven't advanced in the tournament, because I'd have to forfeit the next match. As the 2003 U.S. Open gets underway, Pete announces his retirement. He stops several times during his news conference to collect himself. I find myself deeply affected as well. Our rivalry has been one of the lodestars of my career. Losing to Pete has caused me enormous pain, but in the long run, it's also made me more resilient. If I'd beaten Pete more often, or if he'd come along in a different generation, I'd have a better record, and I might go down as a better player, but I'd be less. For hours after Pete's news conference, I feel a sharp loneliness. I am the last one standing. I'm the last American Slam winner still playing. I tell reporters, you sort of expect to leave the dance with the ones you came with. Then I realize this is the wrong analogy, because I'm not leaving the dance. They are. I'm still dancing. I reach the quarters. I face Coria, who knocked me out of the French Open. I'm itching to lace them up, get out there, but we're delayed for days by rain. Hold up in the hotel, there is nothing to do but wait and read. I watch raindrops slide down the window, each one as gray as the hairs of my stubble. Each raindrop seems like a minute forever melting away. Gil forces me to drink Gil water and rest. He says it's going to be good, but he knows. Time is running out. Finally, the clouds part, and we're on the court, and Coria isn't the same guy I saw in Paris. He has a leg injury, which I exploit. I run him, merciless, grind him down to dust, and win the first two sets. In the third set, I have 4 match points and lose them all. I look to the box and see Gil squirming. In my entire career, he's never once taken a bathroom break during one of my matches. Never. Not once. He says he doesn't want to take the chance that I look to my box and not see him there and panic. He deserves better than this. I refocus. I click the lens left, then right, and serve out the match. There is no time to rest. All the rain has shrunk the tournament schedule. I have to play the semifinal the next day against Ferrero, who just won the French Open. He has so much confidence, it's shooting from his pores. He's 100 years younger than I am, and it shows. He puts me away in 4 sets. I bow to all 4 corners, blow kisses to the crowd, and I think they know I've given them everything. I see Jaden and Stephanie waiting outside the locker room. Stephanie, 8 months pregnant with our second child, and the disappointment of the loss slides away like a raindrop. Our daughter is born on October 3, 2003, another beautiful intruder. We name her Jazelle, and as we did with our son, we secretly vow she won't play tennis. We don't even have a tennis court in our backyard. But there is something else that Jazz Agassiz won't do, sleep. She makes her brother seem like a narcoleptic. Thus, I leave for the 2004 Australian Open looking like a vampire. Every other player, meanwhile, looks as if he's had 12 hours of sack time. They're all bright-eyed and muscular. They seem bulkier than in years past, as if they all have their own gills. My legs stay fresh until the semis, when I run into Safin, who plays like a dingo. He missed most of last year with a wrist injury. Now, fully healed and rested, he's unstoppable. Side to side, back and forth, our rallies take forever. Each of us refuses to miss, to make an unforced error, and after 4 hours, neither of us wants the win any less. In fact, we each want it a little more. The difference is Safin's serve. He takes the 5th set, and I wonder if I've just had my last hurrah in Australia. Is this the end? I've heard this question every other day for months, years, but this is the first time I'm the one asking. Rest is your friend, Gil says. You need more rest between tournaments, and you need to choose your battles ever more carefully. Rome and Hamburg? Pass. Davis Cup? Sorry, can't do it. You need to save up your sap for the big ones, and the next big one is the French Open. As a result, when we arrive in Paris, I feel years younger. Darren looks over my draw and projects a clear path to the semis. In the first round, I play Jérôme Hénel, a 23-year-old from Alsace, ranked number 271, who doesn't even have a coach. No problem, Darren says. Big problem. I come out flat. Every backhand finds the net. I scream at myself, "You're better than this! It's not over yet. Don't end it like this!" Gil, sitting in the front row, purses his lips. It's not just age, and it's not just the clay. I'm not hitting the ball cleanly. I'm rested, but rusty from the time off. Newspapers call it the worst loss of my career. Enel tells reporters that his friends pumped him up before the match by assuring him that he was going to win because I'd recently lost to a player just like him. Asked what he meant by a player just like him, he says, "Bad."
We're down the home stretch, Gil tells reporters. All I can ask is that we don't limp across the finish line.
Come June, I pull out of Wimbledon. I've lost 4 straight matches, my worst losing streak since 1997, and my bones feel like china. Gil sits me down and says he doesn't know how much longer he can watch me go on like this. I need to think long and hard, for both our sakes, about the end. I tell him I'll think about my retirement, but first I need to think about Stephanie's. She's been voted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame, of course. She has more slams than anyone in the history of tennis, besides Margaret Court. She wants me to introduce her at the induction ceremony. We fly to Newport, Rhode Island. A big day. The first time we've ever left the children with someone else overnight. And the first time I've ever seen Stephanie truly, rigidly nervous. She dreads the ceremony. She doesn't want the attention. She worries that she'll say the wrong thing or forget to thank someone. She's shaking. I'm not all that loose myself. I've obsessed for weeks about my speech. It's the first time I've ever spoken in public about Stephanie, and it's like writing something on the kitchen appreciation board for the world to read. JP helps me work through various drafts. I'm overprepared, and as I walk to the dais, I'm breathing hard. Then, the moment I start speaking, I relax, because the subject is my favorite, and I consider myself an expert. Every man should have the chance to introduce his wife at her Hall of Fame induction ceremony. I look out over the crowd, the fans, the faces of former champions, and I want to tell them about Stephanie. I want them to know what I know. I compare her to the artisans and craftsmen who built the great medieval cathedrals. They didn't curtail their perfectionism when building the roof or the cellar or other unseen parts of the cathedrals. They were perfectionists about every crevice and invisible corner, and that's Stephanie. And yet also she's a cathedral, a monument to perfection. I spend 5 minutes extolling her work ethic, her dignity, her legacy, her strength, her grace. In closing, I utter the truest thing I've ever said about her. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce you to the greatest person I have ever known. Chapter 28. Everyone around me talks incessantly of retirement. Stephanie's retirement, Pete's retirement, mine. Meanwhile, I do nothing but play and keep my eye on the next slam. In Cincinnati, to everyone's surprise, I beat Roddick in the semis, which propels me to my first ATP final since last November. Then I beat Hewitt, making me the oldest winner of an ATP event since Connors. The next month, at the 2004 U.S. Open, I tell reporters that I think I have a shot at winning this whole thing. They smile as if I'm demented. Stephanie and I rent a house outside the city in Westchester. It's roomier than a hotel, and we don't have to worry about pushing the stroller across busy Manhattan streets. Best of all, the house has a basement playroom, which is my bedroom the night before a match. In the basement, I can move from the bed to the floor when my back wakes me without disturbing Stephanie. Since fathers don't win slams, Stephanie likes to say, you can go to the basement and feel as single as you need to feel. I see my life wearing on her. I'm a distracted husband, a tired father. She needs to carry more of the load with the children. Still, she never complains. She understands. Her mission, her passion every day, is to create an atmosphere in which I can think solely about tennis. She remembers how vital that was when she played. For instance, driving to the stadium, Stephanie knows exactly which Elmo songs on the car stereo will keep Jaden and Jazz quiet, so Darren and I can talk strategy. Also, she's like Gil about food. She never forgets that when you eat is as important as what you eat. After a match, driving home with Darren and Gil, I know that as we walk through the door, there will be hot lasagna piled on a plate, the cheese still bubbling. I also know Darren's kids and Jaden and Jazz will be fed and clean and tucked away for the night. Because of Stephanie, I make it to the quarters, where I face the number one seed, Federer. He's not the man I beat in Key Biscayne. He's growing before my eyes into one of the game's all-time greats. He methodically builds a lead 2-1, and I can't help but stand back and admire his immense skills, his magnificent composure. He's the most regal player I've ever witnessed. Before he can finish me off, however, play is halted due to rain. Driving back to Westchester, I stare out the window and tell myself, don't think about tomorrow. Also, don't even think about dinner, because the match was cut short and I'm coming home hours earlier than expected. But of course, Stephanie has a source with the weather service. Someone gave her a heads up about the storm as it was swooping down from Albany, and she jumped into the car and rushed home and got everything ready. Now, as we walk through the door, she kisses us all and hands us plates in a single motion, fluid as her serve. I want to invite a judge to the house and renew our vows. The next day, howling winds come, gusts of 40 miles an hour. I fight through the winds and through Federer's hurricane force skills and tie the match at 2-2. Federer glances at his feet, which is how he registers shock. Then he adjusts better than I do. I have a sense he can adjust to anything on the fly. He pulls out a tough fifth set, and I tell anyone who'll listen that he's on his way to becoming the best ever. Before the winds settle down, retirement talk swirls again. Reporters want to know why I keep going. I explain that this is what I do for a living. I have a family and a school to support. Many people benefit from every tennis ball I hit. 1 month after the U.S. Open, Stephanie and I host the 9th annual Grand Slam for Children, which collects $6 million. All told, we've raised $40 million for my foundation. Also, I tell reporters, I have game left. I don't know how much, but some. I still think I can win. Again, they stare. Maybe they're confused because I don't tell them the full story, don't explain my full motivation. I can't, since I'm only slowly becoming aware of it myself. I play and keep playing because I choose to play. Even if it's not your ideal life, you can always choose it. No matter what your life is, choosing it changes everything. At the 2005 Australian Open, I beat Taylor Dent in three sets. Advancing to the fourth round, and outside the locker room, I stop for a very engaging TV commentator, Courier. It's odd to see him in this new role. I can't stop seeing him as a great champion, and yet, TV suits him. He does it well and seems happy. I feel a good deal of respect for him, and I hope he feels some for me. Our differences feel long ago and juvenile. He puts the microphone in front of my mouth and asks, "How long before Jaden Agassi plays Pete's son?" I look into the camera and say, "My biggest hope for my child is that he's focused on something." Then I add, "Hopefully he'll choose tennis because I love it so much." The old, old lie. But now it's even more shameful because I've attached it to my son. The lie threatens to become my legacy. Stephanie and I are more resolved than ever that we don't want this crazy life for Jaden or Jazz. So what made me say it? As always, I suppose it was what I knew people wanted to hear. Also, flush from a win, I felt that tennis is a beautiful sport, which has treated me well, and I wanted to honor it. And maybe, standing before a champion I respected, I felt guilty for hating it. The lie may have been my way of hiding my guilt, or atoning for it. In the last few months, Gil has given a few hard twists to my training. He's had me eating like a Spartan warrior, and the new diet has honed me to a fine edge. Also, I've had a cortisone shot, my third in the last year. Four is the maximum annual number recommended. There are risks, the doctors say. We simply don't know cortisone's long-term consequences for the spine and liver, but I don't care, so long as my back behaves. And it does. I reach the quarters, where again I face Federer. I can't win a set. He dismisses me like a teacher with a dense pupil. He, more than any of the young guns taking control of the game, makes me feel my age. When I look at him, with his suave agility, his shot-making prowess and puma-like smoothness, I remember that I've been around since the days of wooden rackets. My brother-in-law, after all, was Pancho Gonzalez, a champion during the Berlin Airlift, a rival of Fred Perry, and Federer was born the year I met my friend Perry. I turn 35 just before Rome. Stephanie and the children come with me to Italy. I want to get out with Stephanie, see the Colosseum, the Pantheon, but I can't. When I came here as a boy, and as a young man, I was too consumed by inner torments and shyness to leave the hotel. Now, though I'd love to see the sights, my back won't permit it. The doctor says one long walk on pavement can mean the difference between the cortisone lasting 3 months or one. I win my first four matches, then I lose to Coria. Disgusted with myself, I feel guilty about getting a standing ovation. Again, reporters press the question of retirement. I say, "I only think about it 14 times a year, because that's how many tournaments I play each year." In other words, that's how many times I'm forced to sit through these news conferences. In the first round of the 2005 French Open, I play Jarkko Nieminen from Finland. Simply by stepping on the court, I set a record, my 58th slam. One more than Chang, Connors, Lendl, Ferreira. More than anyone in the Open era. My back, however, is in no mood to commemorate the occasion. The cortisone has worn off. Serving is painful. Standing is painful. Breathing is work. I think about walking to the net and forfeiting, but this is Roland Garros. I can't walk off this court. Not this one. They'll have to carry me off this court atop my racket. I swallow eight Advils. Eight. During the changeover, I cover my face with a towel while biting on another towel to quell the pain. In the third set, Gil knows something is terribly wrong. After hitting the ball, I don't sprint back to the center of the court. In all these years, he's never seen me fail to sprint back to the center of the court. It's unthinkable, tantamount to him taking a men's room break during one of my matches. Afterward, walking with Gil to a restaurant, I'm bent over like a giant shrimp. He says,
"We can't keep taking and taking from your body."
We pull out of Wimbledon, try to get ready for the summer hard courts. It's necessary, but feels like a gamble. Now, I'll devote all my time and do all my work for fewer tournaments, which means the margin of error will be narrower, the pressure greater. The losses will hurt more. Gil buries himself in his Da Vinci notebooks. He's proud that I've never injured myself in his gym, and now I can see that, as my body ages, he's tense. His streak is on the line. "Some lifts you just can't do anymore," he says. "Others you'll need to do twice as much." We spend hours and hours in the weight room discussing my core. From here until the finish line, Gil says, it's all about your core. Because I've pulled out of Wimbledon, newspapers and magazines print a fresh batch of eulogies.
"At an age when most tennis players..."
I swear off the newspapers and magazines. In late summer, I play the Mercedes-Benz Cup, and I win. Jaden is now old enough to watch me play, and during the trophy ceremony, he comes running onto the court, thinking the trophy is his, which it is. I go to Montreal and scratch and claw my way to the final against a Spanish kid everyone is talking about, Rafael Nadal. I can't beat him. I can't fathom him. I've never seen anyone move like that on a tennis court. At the 2005 U.S. Open, I'm a novelty, a sideshow, a 35-year-old playing in a slam. It's my 20th year in a row at this tournament. Many of this year's players haven't been alive 20 years. I remember playing Connors and knocking him out of his 20th U.S. Open. I'm not the type to ask, "Where did the years go?" I know exactly where they went. I can feel every set in my spine. I play Răzvan Sabău from Romania in the first round. I've had my fourth and final cortisone shot of the year, so my back feels numb. I'm able to hit my meat and potatoes shot, which gives Sabău problems. When your basic shot hurts someone, when they're falling behind on the shot you can make 100 out of 100 times, you know the day is going to be fine. It's as though your jab is leaving marks on a guy's jaw, and you still haven't thrown your haymaker. I beat him in 69 minutes. Reporters say it was a massacre. They ask if I feel bad about beating him. I say, "I would never want to deprive anybody of the learning experience of losing." They laugh. "I'm serious." In the second round, I play Ivo Karlovic from Croatia. They list him as 6'10", but he must have been standing in a ditch when they measured. He's a totem pole, a telephone pole, which gives his serve a sick trajectory. When Karlovic serves, the box technically becomes twice as large. The net becomes a foot lower. I've never played anyone so big. I don't know how to prepare for an opponent his size. In the locker room, I introduce myself to Karlovic. He's sweet, fresh-faced, starry-eyed about being in the U.S. Open. I ask him to raise his serving arm as high as he can. Then I call Darren over. We crane our necks, looking up, trying to see the tips of Karlovic's fingers. We can't. Now, I say to Darren, "Try to imagine a racket in that arm." And now I imagine him jumping. And now, imagine where the face of the racket would be, and imagine the ball zinging off that racket. It's like he's serving from the freaking blimp. Darren laughs. Karlovic laughs. He says, "I would trade you my reach for your return game." Fortunately, I know Karlovic's height will also be a liability for him at times in the match. Low balls will be problematic, Lunging won't be easy. Also, Darren says Karlovich's movement is dodgy. I remind myself not to spend energy worrying about how many times he aces me. Just wait for the one or two times he misses a first serve, then pounce on that second. Those will decide the match. And though Karlovich knows this also, I need to make him know it more. I need to make him feel it by applying pressure on the second serve, which means never missing. I beat him in straight sets. In the third round, I play Tomas Berdicht, a tennis player's player. I faced him before, nearly 2 years ago, in the second round of the Australian Open. Darren warned me,
"You're about to play an 18-year-old kid who has real game, and you'd better be on it. He can rip the ball up both sides, he has a bomb of a serve, and in a few years, he's going to be top 10."
Darren wasn't overselling it. Berdicht was one of the best tennis players I'd faced all year. I beat him in Australia 6-0, 6-2, 6-4, and felt fortunate. I thought, good thing this is only best of five. Now, surprisingly, Berdicht hasn't improved much since then. His decision-making still needs work. He's like me before I met Brad, thinks he needs to win every point. He doesn't know the value of letting the other guy lose. When I beat him, when I shake his hand, I want to tell him to relax. It takes some people longer than others to learn, but I can't. It's not my place. Next, I play Xavier Malis from Belgium. He moves admirably well and has a slingshot of an arm. He features a meaty forehand and an acing serve, but he's not consistent. Also, his backhand is mediocre. It looks as if it should be great, because he's so comfortable hitting it, but he's more interested in the way it looks than actually executing it. He simply cannot hit a backhand up the line, and if you can't do that, you can't beat me. I control the court too well. If you can't hit a backhand up the line, I'll dictate every point. An opponent has to move me, stretch me off the mark, and put me in a position where I'm dealing with him, or else he'll have to play on my terms. And my terms are harsh, especially as I get older. The night before the match, I have a drink with Courier at the hotel. He warns me that Malis is playing well. "Maybe," I say, "but I'm actually looking forward to it. You won't hear me saying this often, but this is going to be fun." The match is fun, like a puppet show. I feel as if I'm holding a string, and each time I pull it, Malis jumps. I'm astonished yet again by the connection between two players on a tennis court. The net, which supposedly separates you, actually links you like a web. After two bruising hours, you're convinced that you're locked in a cage with your opponent. You could swear that his sweat is spraying you, his breath is fogging your eyes. I'm up 2-0, dominating. Malis has no faith in himself. He doesn't believe he belongs out here. But as the third set starts, Malis finally gets tired of being pulled from side to side. Such is life. He gets mad, plays with passion, and soon he's doing things that surprise even himself. He's hitting that backhand up the line, crisply, consistently. I glare at him with an expression that says, "I'll believe that if you keep doing it." He keeps doing it. I see relief in his face and body language. He still doesn't think he's going to win, but he does think he's going to make a good show, and that's enough. He takes the third set in a tiebreak. Now I'm livid. I have better things to do than stand out here with you for another hour. Just for that, I'm going to make you cramp. But Malis isn't taking orders from me anymore. One set, one little set, has completely changed his demeanor, restored his confidence. He's no longer afraid. He only wanted to make a good show, and he has. So now he's playing with house money. In the fourth set, our roles reverse, and he dictates the pace. He wins the set and ties the match. In the fifth set, however, he's spent. whereas I'm just beginning to draw on funds long deposited in the bank of Gil. It isn't close. Coming to the net, he smiles, accords me tremendous respect. I'm old, and he's made me older, but he knows that I've made him work, that I've forced him to dig deep and learn about himself. In the locker room, Courier finds me, punches my shoulder. He says,
"You called your shot. You told me you were going to have fun. You looked like you were having fun."
Fun. If I had fun, why do I feel as if I got hit by a truck? I'm ready for a month in a hot tub, but my next match looms, and my opponent is playing like a man possessed. Blake. He smoked me the last time we met in D.C. by getting and staying aggressive. Everyone says he's grown steadily better since that day. My only hope is that he doesn't play aggressive this time out, especially since it's cooler. In cool weather, the court in New York plays slower, which favors a guy like Blake, who's so damned fast. On a slow court, Blake can get to everything, and you can't, and thus he can make you press. You feel a need to do more than you normally do, and from there, everything goes haywire. The moment we step onto the court, my worst nightmare comes true. Blake is Mr. Aggressive, standing inside the baseline on my second serves, taking full cuts off both wings, making me feel urgency right from the opening minute. He smothers me in the first set, 6-3. In the second set, he gives me a second helping of the same, 6-3. Early in the third set, the match takes on shades of Malice, except I'm Malice. I can't beat this guy. I know I can't. So I may as well just try to give a good show. Freed from thoughts of winning, I instantly play better. I stop thinking, start feeling. My shots become a half second quicker. My decisions become the product of instinct rather than logic. I see Blake take a step back and register the change. What just happened? He's been beating my brains in for 7 straight rounds, and at the end of the 8th, I land one sneaky punch, wobbling him just as the bell rings. Now he's walking to his corner, unable to believe that his hobbled, demoralized opponent still has life. Blake has a huge following in New York, and they're all here tonight. Nike, which no longer endorses me, gives his supporters t-shirts and urges them to cheer. When I outplay Blake in the third, they stop cheering. When I win the set, they fall silent. Throughout the fourth set, Blake's panicking, no longer being aggressive. I can see him thinking, can almost hear him thinking. Damn, I can't do anything right. I win the fourth set. Now that Blake has seen the benefits of my not thinking, he decides he's going to try it. As the fifth set unfolds, he turns off his brain. At last, after nearly 3 hours, we meet on equal terms. We're both on fire, and his on fire is slightly better than my on fire. In the 10th game, he has a chance to serve out the match. Then he starts thinking again, the contrarian brain. He presses. I hit 3 first-class returns, break him, and the crowd changes its mind. They chant, "Andre! Andre!" I serve. I hold. During the changeover, the stadium sounds like a rock concert. My ears are ringing. My temples are pounding. It's so loud that I wrap my head in a towel. He serves. He holds. We're going to a tie break. I've heard old-timers say that the fifth set has nothing to do with tennis. It's true. The fifth set is about emotion and conditioning. Slowly, I leave my body. Nice knowing you, body. I've had several out-of-body experiences over my career, but this one is healthy. I trust my skill, and I step out of its way. I remove myself from the equation. At match point, 6-5, I hit a solid serve. He returns to my forehand. I hit a quality ball to his backhand. He's moving around it, and I know, mistake. If he's running around my quality ball, that means he's pressing. He's not thinking clearly. He's putting himself out of position, letting the ball play him. He's not giving himself an opportunity to hit the best possible shot. Thus, I know that one of two things is about to happen. He's going to be handcuffed by my ball and hit it weakly, or he's going to be forced into an error. Either way, I have a pretty good idea the ball is coming right here. I look at the spot where it's sure to land. Blake wheels, throws his lower torso out of the way, and cold cocks the ball. It lands 10 feet from where I expected. Winner. I was completely wrong. I do the only thing I can do. Walk back, prepare for the next point. At 6-all, we have a murderous rally, backhand to backhand, and I'm a big loose bag of rattling nerves. In a 10-stroke backhand rally, you know somebody's going to raise the stakes at any moment, and you're always sure it's going to be your opponent. I wait and wait, but with each stroke, Blake doesn't raise the stakes. So it falls to me. I step in as if I'm going to cane the ball, and instead, I had a backhand drop shot. I'm all in. There are times in a match when you want to just put a solid, serviceable swing on the ball, but your blood is so full of adrenaline that you hit it big. This happens often to Blake, not with his swing, but his speed. He runs faster than he means to run. He feels so much urgency that he sprints to a ball and gets there sooner than he anticipated. This is what happens now. Sprinting all out for my backhand drop, he has the racket gripped in such a way that he's going to have to dig, but instead, he gets there so fast he doesn't need to dig, meaning the ball is on him and he has the wrong grip. Instead of crushing the ball, as he should, he's forced by his grip to punch the ball. Then he holds ground at the net, and I lace a backhand up the line. It passes him by a fair margin. Now he's serving at 6-7. I have match point again. He misses the first serve. I have a nanosecond to decide where he's coming with his second serve. Aggressive? Safe? I decide he's going to err on the side of safety. He's going to roll it to my backhand. So how aggressive do I want to be? Where do I want to station myself? Should I make an irrevocable decision, stand where I can kill the ball if I'm correct, but where I won't be able to reach it if I'm wrong? Or should I split the difference, stand in the middle ground, where I'm able to hit a moderately good shot on most serves and a perfect shot on none? If there is to be a final decision in this match, one final decision on this night of 100,000 decisions, I want that final decision to be mine. I irrevocably commit. He serves, as expected, to my backhand. It hangs just where I thought it would hang, like a soap bubble. I feel all the hairs on my body rise. I feel the crowd rise. I tell myself, quality cut, rip it, rip it, rip it, you fuck. As the ball leaves my racket, I track every inch of its flight. I see the shadow of the ball converging with the ball itself. As they slowly become one, I'm saying aloud, ball, please, please find a hole. It does. When Blake hugs me at the net, we know we've done something special. But I know it better because I've played 800 more matches than he has, and this match stands apart from the others. I've never been more intellectually aware, never felt the need to be more intellectually aware, and I take a certain intellectual pride in the finished product. I want to sign it. After they cut the tape off my feet, after the news conference, Gil and Perry and Darren and Philly and I go to J.P. Clark's for food and drinks. By the time I get back to the hotel, it's 4 in the morning. Stephanie is asleep. As I come in, she sits up in bed and smiles. You're crazy, she says. I laugh. That was unbelievable, she says. You went places out there. I did, baby. I went places. I lie on the floor next to the bed, trying to fall asleep. but I can't stop replaying the match. I hear her voice in the darkness somewhere above me, like an angel. How do you feel? It was a pretty cool way to spend an evening.